So these three figures down there already show essentially the plan of my talk. I first want to talk about finite black hole simulations specifically geared towards data analysis needs for LIGO, gravitational wave detectors. And in the latter part of the talk, I want to talk about some a little bit more esoteric things about properties of Einstein's equations rather like directly geared towards gravitational waves. You probably all know that Einstein's equations admit wave solutions which travel at the speed of light. And you probably also know that significant efforts are underway to detect these waves. So here's a picture of one of the LIGO sites in Hanford. LIGO achieved its design sensitivity and took a full year of coincident data ending last fall. And they're now analyzing their initial data. No gravitational waves have been announced. No detection has been announced yet. There are more gravitational wave detectors around. LIGO, CHEO in Germany, Virgo in Italy, TAMA in Japan. And there's a space-based mission, LISA, which is going to fly in about 10 years. All these space... And gravitational waves are being sourced by changing quadrupole moments, most prominently by compact binary objects. If you have a compact binary, you can figure out the orbital frequency simply by using Kepler's law, and you can get the gravitational wave frequency as twice the orbital frequency. For a black hole binary, plugging in a separation close to merger, a couple of Schwarzschild radii, you find a gravitational wave frequency of roughly 2 kilohertz divided by the total mass of the system in solar masses. So for stellar mass black holes, roughly of order 1 to 100 solar masses, the frequencies will be in the LIGO frequency range, the ground-based detectors. And for supermassive black holes, 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 7 solar masses, those will be in the LISA frequency band of a few tenths of millihertz. And so LIGO and LISA were designed precisely like this, for LISA looking at supermassive black holes, the centers of galaxies, for instance, tracing out galaxy mergers by following the black hole mergers at the centers throughout the history of the universe. And LIGO, again, its frequency range was optimized to look at stellar mass objects, stellar mass black holes, stellar mass neutron stars. The signals, particularly in LIGO, are tiny and are overwhelmed by noise. So the only way to find the signals in the detector output is using cross-correlation. For that, one needs a template of the expected waveform. One multiplies the detector output by the template and integrates in time. If a true signal is in the data, it will coherently, the information, signal to noise will coherently add up, and one gets an output. The noise in the data will not be coherent with the template, and therefore it will average to zero. And so on the right-hand side here, there's an example of a simulated data stream with a signal injected. And if you now cross-correlate with a template, at the right time of arrival, you get a large peak in here, and otherwise, you just see the noise. In order to do this cross-correlation, the phase of the template is crucial. If you're out of phase, if the template is out of phase of the real signal, you no longer get coherent accumulation of signal to noise, and the signal strength drops up tremendously. It turns out the most restrictive requirements of the phase come from parameter estimation. And for that, the phase error should be roughly 1 over the signal to noise. And for advanced LIGO, signal to noise is expected to be in the order of 8 to 50 or so. And so we would like to have a phase accuracy of the template of a few hundredths of a radian. A binary black hole proceeds through three stages during its life. First, there's an in-spiral phase with the two black holes orbiting each other. The binary will emit energy and angular momentum in gravitational radiation. And so the orbit will shrink, will tighten, and the eccentricity of the orbit will also be reduced. In fact, it will be reduced even faster than the separation. So close to the merger of the black hole, of the binary, the orbital eccentricity will be extremely small, 10 to minus 5, 10 to minus 6. Then the two black holes collide with each other and form one larger distorted black hole, which subsequently rings down to form to a stationary Kerr black hole. And for these three phases of the black hole simulations, there exist different tools to compute the waveform. For the in-spiral phase, early on, the velocity is still small, and one can use a perturbative expansion in velocity, V over C, to solve Einstein's equations. This is called post-Newtonian expansion. It has been carried out to quite high order, up to V over C to the seventh. However, nevertheless, close to merger, V over C becomes too large, and the post-Newtonian approximation breaks down. And then one needs to use direct numerical simulations to compute the waveform. The merger itself is highly dynamical and nonlinear and must be computed through numerical simulations. And the ring down can either be done with numerical simulations again or with black hole perturbation theory. If one has a code to run the that can do the merger of a binary black hole, it typically can also do the ring down. And so what one does is one just keeps on running. And so here are at least two tasks for numerical relativity. One is to simulate the late in-spiral and merger to get the waveforms you cannot get with analytical means. And the second task is to decide what late means. At what point does post-Newtonian theory become inaccurate enough that it can no longer be used to compute gravitational waves for data analysis purposes? So let's now turn to how one actually goes about simulating black holes. And I'll start this. Yeah?
Is there a plausibility argument as to whether if one didn't do any numerical relativity, just post-Newtonian expansion would be sufficient to generate templates or insufficient for the real experiment?
Well, that depends on the mass of the black holes.
Okay.
So the frequency, both of the in-spiral and of the merger, is inversely proportional to the mass of the black hole. The larger the black hole mass is, the lower the frequencies. And so depending what mass of black holes you have, a different part of the signal is in the LIGO sweet spot in the highest sensitivity range. For sufficiently low masses, only the in-spiral part is relevant, and then post-Newtonian theory is perfectly adequate. For instance, for binary neutron stars. For sufficiently heavy black holes, only the merger and ring down is in the LIGO frequency band, and then you must have numerical simulations.
Presumably, LIGO was designed for the first use. That's why that's the sweet spot. Is that correct?
LIGO's design was a compromise out of all these sources. And it just happened to be the way that's the frequency. So, yeah, let's go back for a second. So here's the LIGO frequency spectrum. It turns out you cannot go to lower frequencies because you're limited by seismic noise. And if you want to go to higher frequencies, you're limited by shot noise. And so that in some sense puts the sweet spot around 100 hertz, which also happens to be a good frequency range both for, say, 10 solar mass black holes or so, as well as neutron stars.
What are those spikes in the diagram?
Oh, I only know a single one, and that's the one that's. So this one is at 120 hertz, so this is just 60 hertz squared. And the other ones, I have to admit, I don't know. So there are various resonances in the instrument. Some of these spikes come, for instance, from the mirror suspension. It also has some resonant frequencies and things like that. Okay, back to a first overview of black hole simulations. So I'm starting here with some overview of problem characteristics. We have a few different length scales in the problem. The black holes have size of about 1 in appropriate units. They're separated by about 10 close to merger. And the wavelength of the emitted radiation is of the order 100 to a few hundred. And one would like to extract the gravitational radiation several wavelengths away in order to be in the radiation zone, where the wave form is actually already representative of the waveform that would have been observed at infinity. The gravitational wave flux is a very small fraction of all the energy in the system. So you have this fairly heavy black hole going about, a lot of rest mass going about in circles, and the in-spiral lift is driven by this very small change of this energy. We require, as already mentioned, very high phase accuracy, a fraction of a radian, perhaps much better, out of however many cycles of the frequency are within the LIGO frequency band. And the final property of the solutions is that the solutions are smooth. And this will be important for our numerical technique later on. There are mostly two computational approaches pursued to simulate these systems. One is finite difference with adaptive mesh refinement, which is done by many different groups. Albert Einstein Institute in Potsdam, Goddard, Jena, the Louisiana State University, and so forth. And these simulations typically are very, very well suited to computing the merger part of the waveform and perhaps a short in-spiral. But they're not very well suited to long, accurate in-spiral simulations because of the characteristics I put up on the left-hand side, the separation of the length scales, and in particular, the small energy flux driving the in-spiral. So among the great results obtained by the finite difference codes are exploration of binary black hole kicks, for instance. You have two black holes which are asymmetric, different masses of non-equal different spin states. Then usually gravitational radiation is emitted also in an asymmetric fashion. And that leads at the end of the day to a net linear momentum transfer on the final black hole. It gets a kick and will move away from the center of mass of the original black hole binary. For unequal masses, the kick is up to 150 kilometers or so. For spinning black holes, it can be quite large. If one has two black hole spins in opposite directions, both in the orbital plane. And that's a configuration which is called the superkick configuration. One can get kick velocities up to about 3,500 kilometers per second. The second approach.
Yeah. Can I just add, is there a reason to think that that might be a typical configuration? Or is it?
No, there's no reason to think that this might be a typical configuration. Because, for instance, if you have accretion disks or so, then typically the spins should be aligned. And also, during the in-spiral, there's a tendency for the spins to align themselves orthogonal to the orbital plane. But it happens to be that in this situation, the kick velocity is biggest. And one simple argument why this would be the case was given first by Pretorius, is if you look at this configuration and look at the frame fighting of black hole A, it tries to push black hole B up. If you look at the frame fighting of black hole B, it tries to push black hole A up. And so they're pushing themselves out of into the same direction. And it turns out that actually gives moderately accurate predictions of how big the kick should be. So the second approach being pursued to do binary black holes is using multi-domain spectral methods. This is done by the Caltech-Cornell collaboration, of which I am a member. And what we can do is essentially orthogonal to the other groups. We are very, very good with long in-spiral simulations. We can also do merger simulations since earlier this year. However, mergers still are very, very difficult and require a lot of hand-holding. We hope to improve on that in the future. So let's talk a little bit more about spectral methods because they're not very common, or not as common as finite difference methods. The fundamental idea behind spectral methods is that one expands the solution in terms of basis functions. For example, Fourier series, Chebyshev polynomials, or spherical harmonics. If one chooses basis functions which form a complete set, and one expands up to uses all basis functions, of course, this wouldn't be any approximation at all. The approximation comes in by truncating this series after a finite number of terms. And this attempts to be the only approximation that comes in. Once we have a function in this form, for instance, we can now take derivatives of this function without any further approximations because we know analytically the derivatives of our basis functions. And usually it's computationally cheapest to compute derivatives by going to the spectral coefficients and then applying certain relations between spectral coefficients and then going back to the physical space. For instance, if you have a Fourier series, to get the derivative, you multiply the spectral coefficients by ik. The nonlinear terms, however, are easiest found in physical space, where we evaluate the solution at grid points and simply compute whatever nonlinear terms we have at the grid points. For elliptic problems, there is no time dependence, and so the spectral coefficients uk delta are just numbers. And when one substitutes this expansion into the elliptic problem, one ends up with a large set of coupled nonlinear algebraic equations fixing these coefficients uk delta. For binary black hole, typically of the order of a million or so. For hyperbolic problems, substituting this expansion into the evolution equation essentially gives evolution equations for these spectral coefficients, and which are then involved with the method of lines on the color time stepping or Dorman-Prinz time stepping.
What is the boundary condition?
I'll get to boundary conditions later.
Yeah.
The second ingredient is a domain decomposition. What we would like to do is we'd like to simulate two black holes with the interiors of each black hole excised because there are the singularities inside the black holes. And so the computational domain is R3 with two excised spheres. And this computational domain cannot easily be handled with standard basis functions. Basis functions are best for simple topologies like a sphere or a cylinder or a cube. So we start by surrounding our black holes with a set of concentric spherical shells, which are then surrounded by a set of cylinders and more cylinders. And far away, we have a third set of cylindrical shells centered at the center of mass, which overlaps the cylinders in the interior, and we have just a large set of concentric spherical shells pushing the outer boundary as far out as we like to be. The advantage of this approach is that it puts resolution where it needs to go. For instance, close to the black hole, the spacetime is approximately spherically symmetric, and an expansion spherical harmonics is well adapted to it. Far away, we only have outgoing gravitational radiation, which has very little angular structure, n equals 2, 4, and 8 perhaps. And so we can get away doing all these outer spherical shells with the same low fixed angular resolution, perhaps l equals 16. And so the cost of moving the outer boundary further away only grows linearly with the outer boundary radius. If you wanted to do this with Cartesian finite difference codes, you would have to resolve both all x, y, and z coordinates. And so moving the outer boundary further away at high resolution actually increases the cost like the cube of the outer boundary radius. Here are two exemplary graphs showing why we actually go for all this effort. And the fundamental reason for that is that if the solutions are smooth, which we expect to be the case for Einstein's equations, then spectral methods give exponential convergence. So the left plot shows one example of solving the initial value equations. And this end here is the cube root of the total number of basis functions, so some approximation of the number of degrees of freedom per dimension. And you see, as we on a linear scale here going up, and as you see, as you increase resolution, the error goes down exponentially on this log scale here. And even on a very coarse grid with only 30 cube basis functions, you already get errors of about 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4. And we can push it down a lot by merely doubling or tripling the amount of the resolution per dimension. The right plot also shows comparison between the finite difference method and the spectral method. Once again, for binary black hole initial data, and you can read this plot in two different ways. You can ask, for instance, I want an error of about 10 to the minus 4. How much time do I have to invest? Or you can ask, I have 20 minutes while I drink a cup of coffee. What accuracy can I compute in this time? And in both cases, usually the spectral method wins. A final point I thought is quite neat pointing out here is the way how we represent the basis functions in each individual subdomain. So what we have coded is a set of essentially building blocks, interval, circle, S2, B2, B3, as well as a tensor product to combine these. And so having this tensor product coded, we can build up the more complicated topologies by just taking products of the simple one. And you can do easily, for instance, a cylinder as a B2 cross I1, or a cylinder without the center as an I1 in radius, an S1 in angle phi, and an I1 in along the C-axis. And you can also contemplate doing more complicated things, which might be very verified for higher dimensional gravity. And paired with the efficiency of spectral methods, that we can get away with so few basis functions, I think we can actually do problems with, say, 4 or 5 life dimensions if we find good problems to work on. Another nifty thing is that we can also represent topology by using multiple subdomains. For instance, you can represent a sphere by 6 distorted squares. So having talked about the infrastructure, let's talk a little bit about the equations we're trying to solve. They're written down very quickly. We want to solve Einstein's equation in vacuum, which simply means that the Ricci tensor of the space-time metric G must vanish. Writing out the Ricci tensor, one finds that the highest order derivative terms are a wave operator acting on the metric, plus a second term, derivatives of these contracted Christoffel symbols. The first term is very nice. Wave operators are always nice. But the second term destroys any mathematical notion of these equations. With the second term, Einstein's equations are neither hyperbolic nor elliptic nor anything. And one way around this has been realized all the way back in the 1920s. And that is to note that these contracted Christoffel symbols actually are just coordinate derivatives. So if one, for instance, chooses coordinates x such that box x equals 0, then these Christoffel symbols vanish, and therefore this nasty second term vanishes. This idea can be generalized from, so if this is 0, the coordinates are called harmonic coordinates. If it's non-zero, then this is called generalized harmonic coordinates. And the same idea still works. So you require that box of x is some function h, which we have chosen ahead of time. If this is the case, well, gamma is this function we have chosen ahead of time. And so this term simply becomes the derivative of a function we have chosen ahead of time and no longer messes up our evolution equations. This, however, will only work if box of x indeed is h. And so what we have done now is we have introduced a new constraint in our problem, namely that h minus box of x is indeed 0. And the breakthrough of Franz Praetorius in 2005 was precisely to show how this constraint can be enforced. And the trick is by adding a new term, this red term here, to the right-hand side of the evolution equations. If the constraints are satisfied, the C is 0, and this red term vanishes. So for the constraint satisfying solutions of the new problem, as well as the original Einstein equations, are identical. However, if the constraints are not satisfied, then one can show that, at least for perturbations around flat space, the constraints decay away exponentially on a timescale gamma, which is a freely choosable parameter here. So talking about boundary conditions, which was just asked about, there are two different kinds of boundaries in the problem. The one are boundaries inside the black hole. One reason why we like the generalized harmonic system is that all the speeds of the system are at best the speed of light. So as the light cones tip over and point completely into the interior of the black hole, So do the characteristic speeds of the problem. And in the red boundary out here, up here in this illustration, is turns out to be a pure outflow boundary of our evolutionary problem. And so we don't need to apply any boundary conditions there. At the outer boundary, life is much more complicated. The outer boundary conditions need to satisfy several conditions. They must prevent influx of constraints. So we have chosen initial data without constraints. We have set up evolution equations, which do not allow constraints to grow in the bulk. But we also need to make sure that no constraints enter through boundaries. The outer boundaries should also be transparent to outgoing gravitational radiations. We don't want them to be reflected back into. We shouldn't have incoming gravitational radiations. And finally, we also would like to minimize reflection of gauge modes at the outer boundary. And once all this is in place, we can actually go about and evolve black holes. And what we find if we start evolving a black hole from quasi-circular initial data is that looking at the separation, initially the separation remains constant, and then the black hole folds in, moves out again, and folds in further. The right plot here shows the radial velocity. It starts approximately at zero and then oscillates around a lot. So what this shows is that quasi-circular initial data leads to eccentric in-spirals simply because we have neglected the radial velocity when constructing the initial data. We can now take information from this plot and choose better initial data parameters to minimize the eccentricity of the in-spiral. And when we do this, indeed we find that the eccentricity is removed about a factor of 10 or so at every iteration. So after running two short evolutions, we were able to construct initial data, which results in eccentricity of only a few parts in 10 to the minus 5. Here's again a comparison between the orbital trajectories of the quasi-circular initial data. The trajectories cross each other and as the black holes orbit around. And here's the low eccentricity run, where we get this extremely nice spiral pattern of the in-spiral. And so at the end of the day, we now have finally obtained a waveform after a lot of slides and a lot of effort, which, for instance, for a 10 plus 10 solar mass binary, corresponds only to about 0.4 seconds. And for higher mass black holes, this time scale would be longer proportional to the mass. For smaller mass black holes, the time scale would be shorter. Of course, there also need to be a couple of movies. Having spent so much effort on getting this. Hello? Ah, just a movie. Having spent so much effort on these simulations. This is a pity, I have the movie on my screen. Interesting. It is playing on my screen, yes. This hasn't happened to me before, that you can see the movie on the screen, but not in real, but not on the big screen. Okay, apologies for that. So here are the black holes going about in circles. The lower half of this plot shows the equatorial plane. Color codes are the lapse function, the rate of flow of time. The height of this. Okay, I won't worry about this.
So I haven't worked much with units, but yeah. If you send it to just that screen and not this one, it would be easy to roll up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting enough, I never had this problem before.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. You usually have to do the switch before you
plan. Yeah. Oh, this is still the movie? Okay. Well, now we have this one up there again.
Wait, you get it, so you can't get it.
No. Yeah. Apparently not. Interesting. It depends on the MPEG player you're using. That's an interesting observation. Okay, so here comes the movie again. Apologies for that. As I said, the lower plane shows a cut through the equatorial plane, color-coded by the lamps. Height of the surface is the scalar curvature of the three-dimensional geometry, and the arrows indicate the shift, the frame tracking. And so we see the in-spiral. Eventually, the black holes merge. At that point, the movie stops for a couple of seconds. You can see the inner apparent horizons and the outer one. And then the black hole rings down to a stationary curved black hole. So. Here's another movie which shows the gravitational radiation being emitted. So what this one shows is psi 4, the magnitude of psi 4, the outgoing gravitational radiation. Initially, there's a pulse of chunk radiation propagating out, which comes about because the initial data, the black holes are not completely in equilibrium. They have some quasi-normal ringing settling down after a couple of m. And this leads to this pulse going out. And it's precisely because of this pulse of short frequency waves that we would like to have good outer boundary conditions that do not reflect these waves back into the computational domain. I'd like to draw your attention to these little disks here. They show the distortion a like observer would observe it at this location in space. In the orbital plane, it's linearly polarized. Along the polar axis, the gravitational waves are circularly polarized. And now the movie slows down and zooms into the center of the simulation, where for this particular movie, the black holes will not merge because this movie has been done before we had black hole mergers. I did this movie last year, but I still think it's quite a neat movie showing these distortions of LIGO. And it zooms back out again and shows how we can extract the in-spiral gravitational radiation despite the simulation in the center already being dead. Okay, good, this is that. Accuracy, the important thing in all this is to get high quality waveforms. Movies are neat, but they're not really that relevant for scientific research. And so here's our approximate phase error is a function of time during this evolution for runs at five different simulations, at five different resolutions. And we see that as we increase resolution from 42 cubed to about 62 cubed grid points, so only a factor of 1.5, the error drops down by about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. Again, this plot illustrates quite spectacularly the efficiency of spectral methods. And at the end of the day, at high resolution, we indeed achieve an accuracy of a few parts in 10 to the a few hundredths of a radian accuracy as we wanted to. My typically rule of thumb is that this spectral code is about a factor of 10 faster than finite difference codes, while being about a factor of 10 more accurate. Unfortunately, it was also a lot more work to get going than the finite difference codes. So
So if it's faster now and more accurate, why have you not done more inspirals?
We are working on more inspirals.
But is there some fundamental reason why you
Simply time. Running inspirals takes a long time. Here are a couple of examples. Two inspirals for spinning black holes. When spins are anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum, the inspiral proceeds fast and we find fewer orbits. When the spins are aligned, inspiral proceeds slower and there are more orbits. And here's a nifty picture of a space-time diagram of a 6-to-1 mass ratio inspiral, where the black hole pretty much, the heavy black hole pretty much sits in the center, and the small black hole goes around in its orbit. So this is color-coded by the scalar curvature of the horizon, and you see by this blue line the tide that the little black hole rises on the big black hole.
Question. How much spin can you put out into one of these black holes?
A very good question. So my last 10 minutes of this talk deal precisely with that question, so I would defer that question. In order to answer one of the questions I posed in the beginning, how long can you trust post-Newtonian? Let me present some results. Let me first explain to you in two slides how post-Newtonian theory works. So in principle, so as I said already, it's an expansion velocity v. And if you assume a circular orbit with enough work, you can get out the energy of the binary as a Taylor series in the velocity. And you can get out the gravitational wave energy flux as a Taylor series as well. And the leading order here is just the Quadrupole formula. The leading order here is just the Newtonian energy. In order to get now an evolution out of post-Newtonian theory, one assumes energy balance. But the change in energy equals the flux. And from that, you can derive an equation that gives you the change in velocity. And from that, you can derive velocity as a function of time and anything else you might want to know. The problem fundamentally is that late in the inspiral, v is not small, but quite big, order 0.3 or so. And so the post-Newtonian series converges very slowly, and higher order terms are feasible. The way post-Newtonian theory deals with higher order terms is through a term called PN approximants. A PN approximant essentially corresponds to a certain choice of how one deals with higher order uncontrolled terms. For instance, you can write the energy balance equation just as I did right now, where the right-hand side here, flux is a Taylor series, and dE dV is a Taylor series. So the right-hand side here is a ratio of two Taylor series. Or you can take the right-hand side and re-expand it in a new Taylor series. Both these approaches are completely equivalent up to your truncation order of the post-Newtonian expansion. Or you could go an even different way and move this term to the left-hand side, expand in a series. And you might want to do this because now you have an equation which you can integrate analytically. So these three approaches go under the names Taylor T1 to Taylor T4. The last one comes in two different flavors. And if you now compare the numerical simulations to these four flavors of post-Newtonian theory, we find the following. So at this point here, about 20 cycles before merger, we are matching post-Newtonian waveforms and numerical relativity waveforms. We force them to have the same phase and the same frequency. So here the phase error is zero. And the second post-Newtonian order, the error increases both towards earlier times and towards later times. As I increase the order, at earlier times, post-Newtonian theory converges very, very well and essentially agrees with our numerical simulation, a very important consistency check. But at later times, PN and NR always disagree. And even worse, the different post-Newtonian approximants can't even agree on a sign. Some converge faster than the numerical waveforms, some converge slower. And recall, the numerical accuracy is about 0.03 radians. So all these deviations are significant and resolved. And interestingly enough, if you look at this blue green line here, it matches extremely well throughout the inspiral. And if you plot the waveforms, you find perfect agreement, both at early times and all the way to the end. But to make this plot here, you of course have to know ahead of time which one of your PN approximants you should be using. If you happen to have used a different one, the plot might have looked like this, and you get completely phasing towards the end. So bottom line is from this work is essentially that some PN approximants can match the numerical waveforms extremely well, but we don't know a priori which one. So we need to run numerical simulations to test whether there's any PN approximant that can actually be used in these last 20 cycles or so.
So is there some inside the country knowing which one works?
Not so far, because we don't have enough test cases. This is the only numerical simulation so far accurately enough to do this type of comparison. And that's the only one we've done so far. In fact, there's absolutely no reason for this green one to match so well. The green waveform was constructed assuming circular orbits. And the inspiral is not circular. And you can show that the assumption of circular orbits should give you a phase error of about 1 to 2 radians. So this must be coincidence. But somehow the error that comes in by assuming circular orbits is canceled by other errors that come in by whatever choice of higher order terms has been made implicitly by choosing that certain PN approximant.
This is for equal mass, right?
This is for equal mass non-spinning. And for spinning black holes, life gets worse, because spinning post-Newtonian waveforms aren't known to that high order. For non-equal mass binaries, life gets worse, because a non-equal mass binary spends more orbits late in the inspiral in the deeply nonlinear regime. So again, it's quite likely that post-Newtonian might perform not as good there. But nevertheless, I think post-Newtonian plays an extremely important role in gravitational wave data analysis. First, for doing everything up to about the last 20 cycles. It's a lot of cycles to be done there. And second, even this later inspiral, post-Newtonian formulae form very, very nice starting points to construct fitting formulas to the numerical simulations. And these simulations, that's what I showed earlier, are precisely designed to do more post-Newtonian comparisons. So these are, again, are very high-quality simulations, which take a long, long time to set up and to run, despite having a fast code.
How long is a really long time?
How long is a really long time? Actual CPU time for the 15-orbit inspiral was about 3 to 4 weeks, or 20,000 CPU hours. Given that computers usually fail, and yet that you have to wait in queues, actually one time is more like 2 months, playing all the important steps beforehand, like removing eccentricity and optimizing domain decomposition, one can easily talk about 4 to 5 months or so. And of course, all this should be improving in the future as we gain more experience into running these kinds of simulations. Yeah, here's another one of these glitches. Supercomputers fail. And in this particular case, some of the visualization output was not dumped to disk. OK, in the last 15 or 20 minutes or so, I'd like to talk a little bit about the properties of Einstein's equations, which came up during our simulations, which I find quite neat, but which are only marginally relevant for LIGO data analysis. But I thought that since this is a theoretical physics institute, it might be the appropriate venue to present this kind of results. The first project was to look at distorted curved black holes, which was done in collaboration with 2 grad students at Caltech, Tony Chu and Mike Cohen. What we do here is we start with a curved black hole in the middle and surround it by an incoming gravitational wave, which is approximately spherical. So here, as a function of radius going from 12 to 18, you see the initial scalar curvature of an initial data set having these 2 spikes here. And on the right plot, again for the initial data, you see the mass of the black hole as we increase the amplitude of the wave and the total AVM energy of the spacetime. And the implicit assumption here is that the difference here is energy in the gravitational wave, which will move in and at a time of about 15, hit the black hole and increase the mass of the black hole. And indeed, if you begin to evolve, here's the mass of the black hole as a function of time. It's pretty much constant at around 15. The mass increases. With higher amplitude waves, not surprisingly, we get a bigger increase in the mass. And the biggest one we've done increases the mass of the black hole by about a factor of 2.5, from 1 to 2.5. So we do hit this black hole quite hard. And as we begin to look at this 0.51 in more detail, we notice that this black line here looks actually quite peculiar. This is a blow-up of the time between 15 and 16 here. And you see that the apparent horizon mass initially stays fairly constant, then jumps, stays constant, and jumps again. These are the individual time steps I'm plotting here. And over the left-hand side, the points were connected by the line. In particular, down here, it looks like there's something going on. But up here, there's nothing going on. The line simply happily continues out of nothing and keeps on straight. Our apparent horizon find that each time step is based on the last time step, so it will, if possible, find a continuous series of apparent horizons. And so we decided to take this picture and run the apparent horizon finder backwards in time, starting at late times and using the later time step at each point as initial guess for the next apparent horizon finder. And indeed, we found more apparent horizons. With apparent horizons, by the way, I mean a surface where the outgoing null geodesics has zero expansion. So I'm using the somewhat sloppy notation and language of numerical relativists here. And now we find behavior that down here it looks like this is kind of half a parabola, and here it's kind of half a parabola. And so with some imagination, you could imagine there should be another surface in between. And indeed, with some more effort, you actually find more of these apparent horizons in between. And there's, in fact, a time, or short interval in time, where there are five apparent horizons surrounding the black hole. So, to make this a little bit more explicit, what might be going on here is a space-time diagram. So time is flowing up, and this is space. And the different surfaces here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, are color-coded between black, blue, and green. And I have a little movie showing how this develops in time, which I will have to start manually again. Apologies.
Yes, feature of these extra-apparent horizons disappear for non-screening?
We don't know. But it's a very interesting question. I would suspect not, because I think it more depends on the property of the incoming gravitational wave and not on the, what the black hole in the middle has been doing. We happen to have started with a spinning black hole because we wanted to examine perturbations of spinning black holes. And so here you see now the development of these apparent horizons as a function of time. It starts fairly quickly in the beginning, so let me start over again. And you see.
Harold?
Yep.
What does this all mean? I mean, what does it mean to be five apparent horizons? Or, and if you're standing by a black hole in between two of them, I mean, what's going on?
So if you have, that's a point we still need to figure out what this actually means and whether it means anything. So one tricky business about apparent horizon is they are slicing dependent. So it might very well be that if you choose a different slicing, there might be even more of them or fewer. We simply don't know right now. And so
did we have any reason to think before that there should always be a slicing where there's only one?
Mathematically speaking, you don't even have any reasons to expect any apparent horizons. So that there are slicings of Schwarzschild known which are sufficiently asymmetric that they don't have an apparent horizon at all. So we always hope that apparent horizons are close to event horizons, but there's no guarantee for that.
If you take a slicing which has several apparent horizons and you graph the expansion of the outgoing mm-hmm. non-rays, presumably it's oscillating
That's my suspicion, which is
not surprising. I mean, you made an initial condition with the wave, the mm-hmm. gravitational wave in it, so it's not terribly surprising.
There are reasons to motivate why this should be happening, but it's nevertheless very neat to actually see in practice. And so here I've stopped at this point here, where we have three horizons, the inner one and the two outer ones just popping up here. And if you keep on evolving, the inner ones will, this was a short region of the five ones, now we're back to three, and the inner two now move towards each other and annihilate. And there's actually a theorem that's saying that the union of all these apparent horizon growth cubes is a smooth surface, and indeed we find it to be a smooth surface. So here's the last picture about this. This is yet a different view of the same situation. The white structure here is the same space-time diagram of the apparent horizon world tubes, this time viewed from below. So you see the apparent horizon pretty much having the same radius until the gravitational wave hits, and it suddenly jumps out here. And the dotted curves here are the location of the event horizon. So you notice, for instance, that the event horizon down here already begins to increase in anticipation of the gravitational wave hitting the black hole at some later time. And you also might notice, or should notice, the twist in the event horizon lines. These are the generators of the event horizon, which are twisted because this is a spinning black hole. And now let me address the question of how high spin can we do. Bottom line is, we want to do pretty high spin because there are suggestions out in the literature that there might be astrophysical black holes with spins of 0.98 or 0.99. And so again, together with Carl Beck Stewart, his job, the Loveless, Bogon, and Tony Chu, we set out to examine whether and how to construct initial data with very, very high spins. The first thing we did was to look at the good old initial data almost everybody is using in numerical relativity, that is called puncture data. And it is very widely used, essentially because it is extremely simple to construct. You only have to solve a single elliptic partial differential equation. And actually, it has been known for a very long time that the maximum initial spin you can get out of this is about 0.998. However, it's also been known for a couple of months now that if you actually take this 0.98 initial data and you evolve it, because of the initial transients in the initial data, the chunk radiation, the spin very rapidly drops down to about 0.93. So with that kind of initial data, you can only do black hole simulations with relaxed spins of 0.93 or around there. Nevertheless, while repeating this, we found a quite interesting behavior. We constructed, for instance, embedding diagrams of these initial data surfaces. They have a two-sheeted topology. Up here is our universe, and down there is a second asymptotically flat end. And as we increase spin, turns out there's a lengthening of growth developing here. And it also turns out that in this growth region, you can solve the initial value problem analytically, at least approximately, and you can actually predict very well what the growth should be looking like. So the dotted line, which you don't even see because it's right on top of the blue line, is the analytical prediction about the radius of the throat and the length of it, and it's right on top of the numerical result. And for instance, the analytical prediction tells us that the length of the throat will increase logarithmically with the spin as we crank up the spin further. Okay, but back to our original idea, what we meant to do is we set out to construct high spin initial data. And so the next thing we tried is what is called quasi-equilibrium initial data, on which I've spent essentially a part of my PhD thesis developing this, which is the initial data we've been using at Caltech and Cornell. It is based on more physical assumptions than just simplicity. We use time independence as part of the assumptions because a binary on a circular orbit should be time independent, and we try to put into the initial data the fact that the black holes should be in equilibrium. And as we crank up our parameter in the initial data that controls spin, we find quite nicely that the spin of the black hole goes up. at least for some time. And then at some point, we fail to find solutions, and the spin actually stops at some finite value in a shape which looks like the lower half of a parabola. If there's a lower half of a parabola, one can conjecture that there's an upper half, and indeed there's an upper half of the parabola. And this was, again, quite a big surprise, because what this means now is that we get for one value of the parameter controlling the spin, we can find two distinct solutions of the initial value problem. Early on, in all other formulations of the initial value equations, there's always a guaranteed unique solutions. And this was the first case where non-unique solutions were found. And subsequently, it turned out you can trace this effect back to a certain term in the equations, which happens to have an unfortunate sign, which causes the linearized operator to be indefinite. So where are we? We have a neat behavior, and we can get a spin of up to 0.99. Unfortunately, similar to the previous initial data I've shown you, again, we have reason to believe that the spin will relax down to about 0.93, 0.94. No success as far as high spins is concerned, but again, very neat properties of Einstein's equations. So let's try again. We too use the same quasi-equilibrium approach as in the previous slide, but here I've neglected to say we've also used some simplistic assumptions, conformal flatness and maximal slicing, which we shall now replace by choices motivated by looking at single analytic Kerr black holes. So we use that free data. We construct initial data where we crank up the omega, the spin parameter again. And this time we find the spin going up, going up, going up, touching unity and going down again. So again, we were surprised for two reasons. First, we didn't really expect the thing to go up all the way to unity. We wanted some high number, but we didn't really expect one exactly. And we're also surprised of it going down again. It turns out part of the puzzle comes about in the way we define the mass. We define mass by using Christodoulou's formula, taking the irreducible mass squared plus a spin contribution, where the irreducible mass is defined by the square root of the apparent horizon. It turns out that this definition here forces S over M squared to be at best unity. And the way to see this is to introduce an externality parameter zeta, spin over the irreducible mass. And then you can rewrite S over M squared, S divided by this expression here, as 1 minus something which is positive. And so there's no surprise now anymore that this thing turns over. And you can also look up what this quantity is for Kerr black hole. It turns out it is always less than or equal to 1, and it is equal to 1 exactly for extremal Kerr black hole. And so when we plot this theta parameter for our initial data sets, what we find is that theta happily goes up. It goes to 1 right at the point where S over M squared is unity, and then it happily continues past 1. So we were once again quite excited. This looked like we have found a super extremal black hole. And what I'm plotting here is the spin and mass based on our inner boundary of our computational grid, which by our boundary condition is forced to be an apparent horizon. So we've looked at this more carefully, and we noted that around the point where theta goes through 1, a second horizon appears outside our inner boundary. And so the second horizon heavily keeps on growing as we increase omega further. And if we're putting this on the plot as well, it turns out the theta of this outermost horizon heavily increases all the way to just short of 1. And then it turns over because the area of this outer horizon increases faster than its spin. So no super extremal black holes for today. But nevertheless, even for this outermost horizon, we find spins as large as 0.9998. So it looks like we really have initial data now, which can produce spins much closer to one. Of course, one also needs to look carefully on what happens in an evolution, because the other initial data sets, the spin relaxes down quite a bit. So we've done some preliminary evolutions, and we find that the spin essentially does not relax at all. Note the scale here, it goes from 0.927 to 0.929, so this is only 0.2%. And here's the initial relaxation of the spin. It's less than 0.1%. Here's another example of a head-on collision. The spin changes only by about a part in 10 to the minus 4. And so we believe we actually now have initial data in hand where we can get spins of at least 0.99 out after relaxation. And so let me summarize and remind you again of all the topics I've talked about. It was quite a diverse talk. I started out with talking briefly about gravitational wave detectors that require accurate templates, explained our spectral evolution code, which can do elliptic and hyperbaric problems, and is based on a fairly flexible and efficient domain decomposition approach. I showed you results for 15 orbit binary black hole experiment merger. So the post-Newtonian numerical relativity comparison tells us that post-Newtonian theory might be untrustworthy in about the last 20 cycles or so. And one needs more simulations for various scenarios to actually determine what the waveforms are for various scenarios and how good each post-Newtonian approximant is for each case. And towards the last half of our talk, I've shown you simulations with multiple horizons and binary black hole of near extremal spins of as big as 0.9998, and several surprises along the way. And all this work has been done, of course, not in isolation, but together with quite a lot of different groups, most of them being based in Caltech or Cornell. It's part of this fairly big collaboration between Caltech and Cornell to simulate black hole spacetimes and neutron star spacetimes. Thank you. Not yet. We actually looked a little bit at Pransticki. So Pransticki simulations have been done about 10 years ago in more symmetric situations, like single black hole in axis symmetry. And for instance, it was found that the event horizon in Pransticki theory may shrink over time. But since then, nobody has looked at Pransticki anymore, because we didn't fully see the relevance of this. So the Pransticki parameter is constrained to be smaller, larger.
Your answer, once you impose the observational constraints, that you shouldn't expect any enhancement and alteration of the template, right? Is that it?
That's essentially it. The second thing is that we didn't know how to get a non-zero scalar field close to the black hole, because in the single black hole simulations, even if it's found an open non-zero scalar field, it always decays to zero. And then we're back to just plain GR. So this kind of work, I believe, will become more important in the near future, because right now everybody in numerical relativity, including myself, I have to admit, is quite busy just simulating traditional GR. But as the traditional GR and the Lyapunov template problem gets under control and becomes no longer as urgent as it is right now, resources will be devoted to these somewhat less traditional theories of gravity.
I mean, continuing on this question, wouldn't the radiation formula be different in the Pransticki theory, so it wouldn't agree with the observation of the slowdown of those neutron stars?
I suspect so. I think the Hall scalar pulsar will also give you some limit on what the Pransticki parameter is, but I don't know what the most stringent test is. I always assume it's the solar system, but it might be the Hall scalar pulsar.
Well, the recent sets of pulsars, I forgot the name, also competitive with the stellar the solar system.
Isn't it? Okay.
So what's your expectation about when the detailed problem of having the templates in the end look? I mean, it's been marvelous watching the story develop over us. But as you think, you know, even for one particular case, you know, in effect, you're talking about months. And okay, whether you're good, I'm saying, you know, maybe weeks or something. But this is still, it seems from an outsider's perspective, still a huge computational problem.
It's a huge computational problem. So you're talking about 1,000 or so templates, which will keep 1,000 CPU computers busy for about 3 years, even on top of all the additional problems of setting up things. So we are working quite heavily on automating and streamlining the process of running these simulations to actually keep big computers busy with multiple simulations at the same time.
Okay.
But so it's on the time scale of about 5 years or so.
Okay.
Just in time for advanced flight.
Yeah, no. Nice.
I'll ask them. What I asked about the hiring momentum is that there were speculations by Jan Levin and other people, I'm sure you know about, that there could be spin orbit interactions that would periodically flip the spins and disrupt the post Newtonian expectations. So are you able to investigate that? Or?
In principle, yes. In practice, it might be very difficult because I would suspect you'd have to start much earlier and simulate many more orbits. Because in these last 15 orbits, radiation reaction is already so strong and it will damp out any chaotic effects.
Okay,
so I suspect you'll have to go early and then.
Good. But so is there then a response to the critique that was made? Was that, you know, if this happened frequently enough, the detection through templates would be much less effective because there would be frequently chaotic and unestimable glitches in the waveforms? Is this still a serious worry, or has this been answered?
I don't know of any data analyst worrying about this. So for binary black holes, for say bigger than say 5 solar masses, when you expect most binary black holes to be, the waveforms in the band are actually fairly short, 20, 30, 50 cycles or so. So it's not that big an issue. For binary neutron stars, it might be an issue, but again, I don't know any data analysts worrying about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the perception in the field is that these claims of chaotic motion are not true. But I don't remember a precise paper actually saying clearly why there shouldn't be any chaotic motion.
Okay, good. More questions? Okay, Harold, I think you're around the rest of today.
Yes.
For a conversation. And just to amplify that comment, I mean, having watched the binary black hole problem probably in my life for only half of its evolution, it's wonderful to actually be able to see movies where they don't just stop at some point.
Yes.
Congratulations.
I also had a slide in there, which I took out because of time constraints, detailing the history of the problem going back to the late 60s and the wormhole evolutions. So this has been going on for 30, 40 years.
It's nice finally to see
you.
Thank you very much.